to order. Members, we have today's focus is on chronic wasting disease. At the end of last session, Senator Ingebrigtsen and I had agreed to have quarterly meetings, and we had one, a joint hearing in October. We had hoped to do that today, but today's schedule did not work out. So the Senate had a hearing before noon, and we are having this one today. I do need a motion to approve the February 13th minutes. I know Representative Lewick was studying them.
Mr. Chair, so move.
Representative Lewick moves the February 13th minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Representative Lewick's motion passes. Overwhelmingly. So today we are having with us representatives from the Department of Natural Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Animal Health, and the University of Minnesota. And I think members will find this informative and also probably newsworthy. So with that, Brian Luth, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See if I can get this started. Again, my name is Brian Lewis. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Wildlife Habitat Program Manager, and I was asked to lead this Adopt a Dumpster project that came as a result of last year's legislation that appropriated $50,000 from the Wild Servant Health Management account in the Game and Fish Fund to provide dumpsters for deer carcass disposal, work with solid waste haulers and other interested parties, encourage volunteer support to make sure they're located in convenient locations, signed, maintained, ensure the carcasses collected are properly disposed of, work with Department of Health and Pollution Control Agency to develop guidelines for hunters, for solid waste facilities and solid waste haulers, and taxidermists and meat processors for proper handling, processing, and disposal. So the chairman mentioned that at the end of October, we had a joint hearing, and at that time we were encountering some difficulty with finding vendors to provide the dumpsters and dispose of the carcasses, but I'm happy to report that we were able to work through those problems, and by the firearm season, we were able to achieve our original goal, which is shown on this map, is to have the top image is the southeast CWD management zone. The bottom image is the north central zone. The green squares, we had dumpsters there as soon as we could get them, and they stayed there until the end of the archery season. We brought in additional dumpsters during the firearm season. Those are represented by the blue triangles just because of the that's where most of the harvest occurs and where most of the need was. This is an image of a typical setup. This is actually a 20-yard dumpster. You can see the liner. We had plywood covers on top of it. There's a sign that we're at all these locations. And in addition to the dumpsters, where we could, we provided some additional equipment that would facilitate hunters processing their deer on site. So there's a tripod, a table to work from, and in a tote would be some cleaning wipes, paper towels, that type of thing, so that hunters could sort of break the animal down right there on the spot, get rid of the bones that we are most concerned of right there in that dumpster. And we tried to get these in the same locations where our self-service sampling stations were, the same location where the hunter brought their deer for the mandatory surveillance during the firearm season. So sort of a one stop is what we were shooting for. We weren't successful in all locations, but in most locations, this whole setup was there. Early on, when we were having some difficulty, we enlisted the help of some of our partner organizations, specifically Bluffland Whitetails Association and the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, were able to place dumpsters at some of these locations early on during the archery season while we went through our bid process. And those are some of the amounts that that they were able to contribute to this effort. Roughly $3,000 from Bluffland's, another $1,000 from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and we did receive a $900 donation from Minnesota Backcountry Hunters and Anglers to offset some of the costs associated with this. Costs as of January 27th, I've got them broken down by the north central zone, so that kind of gives you an idea of that limited area, what this cost versus the larger southeast zone. So roughly $40,000 up in the Crow Wing County area, the north central zone, another $125,000 for the southeast zone for a total of $165,000. I just saw another invoice this morning on my desk for another $3,000, and I know there's an outstanding invoice up in Crow Wing County. So my estimate is it's going to be right about $175,000 for this year at this scale. To provide dumpsters for deer carcass disposal. One of the issues that remains is landfills and their willingness to accept the deer carcasses as a means of disposal. So next I'd like to bring up Dave Benke from the Pollution Control Agency to talk some more about that effort.
Mr. Benke, before you start, just checking, are there any questions from members? I have a question on the amount of money. So we had, there was an appropriation of $50,000. Will we need a after the fact authorization for the expenditure of money that occurred? And that might be a question to you, but also to Mr. Hagemeyer.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question, Mr. Chair.
We appropriated $50,000 and you spent 165, so do we need to authorize that after the fact with law?
Well, it would certainly relieve some of the additional costs that we bore through the Game and Fish Fund and another, I believe, a general fund appropriation that we used for this as well.
Mr. Chair, as the testifier just stated, they do have appropriations that they can use for this purpose. There was a $50,000 direct appropriation for this purpose specifically, but the other appropriations would just be limiting some other work they could do. So you could give them money to reimburse for this if you wanted, but they took it out of a different larger pot of money currently and reduced some other work to fund that.
Mr. Benke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Benke. I'm the director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the Pollution Control Agency. As you may recall, the last time, let me advance that to the next one. Last time we were discussing this, one of the issues that was raised was acceptance of deer carcasses at landfills. We heard this when we started talking in Crow Wing County from the operator about the reluctance to accept that. So what the DNR and the PCA did is we pulled together a landfill working group on chronic wasting disease, including the DNR and the PCA, the Department of Ag, the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Health. We included local meat processors, taxidermists, the landfill operators, some neighboring county landfill operators, as well as waste haulers, contract engineers, and the County Highway Department. The reason we needed to pull all those folks together was to get their perspectives and get their understanding of the chronic wasting disease issues that are out there and how we could best create a disposal system that would help with all of those perspectives that are out there. We had some good discussions and talked about a couple different things. On the next slide. Basically, three different ways to dispose of carcasses existed in the state for us. Alkaline digestion at the University of Minnesota, landfills, and incineration. When we looked at all three of those options, we recognized that the University of Minnesota's facility was a little bit small in terms of collecting and then processing all the waste that could potentially come through the Adopt a Dumpster program. So we looked at lined landfills and we looked at incinerators, and particularly an on-site air curtain incinerator to manage the carcasses and the butcher remains. One thing we didn't want to have was leave those deer on the landscape. That's the way that the disease can be spread the most, that those deer carcasses become a source of the disease and can spread. Landfills, with the research we looked at, would be part of the solution to reduce the risks and provide containment. There's no human health risk associated with landfilling that we could see, and they also, at the health advisory, had so far only been about eating chronic wasting disease positive infected animals. So looking at that, we looked at the research, and a lot of the research at the time we were initially looking was coming out of Wisconsin, and they had a lot of experience, and they applied it to the landfills that they have in terms of how they operated. One of the differences we found, though, in our situation was, if you go to the next slide, you can see the issues. Crow Wing County has a landfill that they operate, and most of the leachate that comes through landfills, and leachate is that material that comes out at the bottom, the water that comes through precipitation and decomposition, and needs to get managed. At Crow Wing County, they recirculate that landfill leachate, and then they spray applicate that on a adjacent piece of property. So that was different than the research we looked at, and so we wanted to make sure we had ways to reduce that risk further. What we looked at was, is the landfill the right place? Do we want to use an air curtain incinerator or some type of combination of the both? You know, that was really what we wanted to do in this situation. By hearing the perspectives, we were able to come to a plan that reduced that risk. For us, that meant, you know, if we were going to put deer in the landfill, we put those above those recirculation lines in the landfill at Crow Wing, that we use an appropriate base soil to contain those prions if they were in the actual deer, and cover as soon as possible to make sure that more leachate wasn't generated by water coming through that. This was consistent with the research at the time. We continue to look at additional research as it comes forward. But in Crow Wing County, we kind of went full circle. We had initially talked about an air curtain incinerator to reduce the risk, and then taking the ash and disposing that in the landfill. This is a picture of the air curtain incinerator that they eventually installed. That's a picture of me in there, so don't go in there if it's on. That's all I can tell you. That gets up above 1,300 degrees, potentially to 2,000 degrees, and does a very good job of denaturing those prions. And all that's left over is ash. That ash, if you go to the next slide, was then taken and disposed of in the landfill itself, towards the top, again, above the recirculation lines, and in an area that was soon to be covered with final cover so that additional precipitation didn't go through that and create more leachate, all along reducing the risk of spreading the prions and containing those in the landfill. And the last slide is something that is connected more to this particular landfill and other landfills that do spray irrigation, is at this site where they spray irrigate the leachate is the first in the area to become green. And so what they ended up doing was to fence it off, because deer love this in the spring. And we wanted to make sure that if there were prions that moved through that system, that the risk was reduced by fencing it off and reducing the deer coming onto the spray irrigation site itself.
Mr. Beck, we have a question. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about the prions going into the leachate. Is there any way that you could tell? Is there any way to test to see if there's any prions in the leachate when you take samples from there?
Mr. Becky.
Mr. Chair and members, I think we'll talk a little bit further about the testing and the progress on the testing with Dr. Larson coming up, but he'll talk a little bit further about that.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many tested positive? How many deer tested positive in the last hunt, the last deer season?
Mr. Becky.
Mr. Chairman and members, the last testing results were there were zero positive in the Crow Wing County area. We'd have to get the DNR if they wanted to come up and talk about the southeast part of the state, but that was in the Crow Wing area. So the good news is the work on reducing the risk was probably worth it, but there's also then the result is that they don't have any positives here and probably have done a real good job in doing that.
Representative Green.
Okay. Then, well, thank you for that. And then there were no deer, but now we're talking about the incineration. And what I'm kind of confused about is if there were any that were positive, and then you incinerated those deer at 2,000 degrees, presumably that kills the prions. So then you're spreading the ash, and you're worried about the prion leach. So what am I missing?
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chairman, members, what we did at Crow Wing County was look at all the risks that were associated with the facility and reduce those to the lowest possible level. We may have gone further than you necessarily need to, but this was a choice of the county in terms of what they wanted to do with this asset that they have. They've been operating that landfill for a long time and plan to do that going forward, and wanted to make sure that they weren't causing an issue that they could do with the steps that they've taken to reduce that risk further.
Representative Guineas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to clarify something here. So we've just heard about what Crow Wing County did.
Representative Guineas, if you could get closer to the microphone.
Yes, we've just heard about what Crow Wing County did. So Southeast is different. So did you put carcasses and landfills in Southeast at all?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was the next place I was going to go, is that in the southeast part of the state, as you recall, we were running into some issues with vendors and disposal locations. We ended up using the La Crosse County landfill for disposal of the adopted dumpster remains, and are going back down to the southeast to talk about a more permanent solution. In the southeast, it looks like there's going to be more ongoing surveillance needed and the testing requirements needed there. Without additional positives in the Crow Wing County area, it may reduce the need for surveillance and may be able to go back to the original zone. So what I think we're needing is down in the southeast to have further conversations. We're going to go back down and talk to Olmsted County about a more permanent solution and talk to the neighboring counties. Not all the waste is disposed in the same place down there. A lot of the counties utilize La Crosse for their waste disposal. And so that was a connection in terms of the disposal of the carcasses. But now we've got to go back and I think and take a look at all of the area and see that we can have, I think, a little bit more long-term reliable disposal. We're going to take a look at the waste energy facility in Olmsted County and see if that's viable, some other options as well. We didn't have enough time in the fall to get ready with the season coming up to have all those conversations, but we plan on doing that beginning in the next couple of weeks here.
Representative Guineas.
Just one follow-up. If we take things to Crow Wing County and they have a problem with their leachate getting on the land, then we would be a responsible party. Is that correct?
Mr. Benke.
I believe if, I'm not sure on the exact chain of custody and how that would work. We've got other with the DNR and the PCA, but also others utilizing that facility. Generally, with the landfills in this state, we've utilized financial assurance and other mechanisms for long-term closure and care of those. But you're probably, correct in assuming that when waste goes in there, whoever puts it in there ends up being responsible as well.
Representative Guineas.
That's an issue I think we need to think about, Mr. Chair, because if they have a leachate problem, I assume it's a lined landfill, and they're applying the leachate and it ends up on a farm, then the way these things track through, we are responsible. So particularly if DNR is putting in or the PCA. So this
Mr. Chair,
feels like a short-term solution to me rather than a long-term solution.
Mr. Chair, members, that's one of the reasons Crow Wing took all the steps that they did, recognizing that it was their system and they're responsible for that as well. That land application site is right adjacent to the landfill. It's land under their control. It's not anyone else's property, and it's part of the landfill system.
We've got two other questions, and then we'll move on. So Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I doubt they're here, but I think it's important to recognize that Crow Wing County really took this seriously, and I think that's really important as far as, the economy up there and the number of folks who deer hunt in that area. I know where my family hunts is perilously close to Crow Wing County, and it's certainly appreciated by a lot of hunters that it was taken this seriously, because we really don't want to see it outside of the southeast zone. I did have a question about the field management with the fencing, and just wondering if you know why they chose a 9-foot high fence.
Mr. Benke.
Mr. Chair and members, I think they looked at the research in terms of the need for that fencing. You know, if we observe that additional fencing is needed in terms of height or whatever, that's, I think, what we looked at, the industry standards for that and what other folks were using. One of the things that they, you know, did right away, though, was recognize all the risks that were there. And I really would applaud Crow Wing County for their effort, too. They went out of their way to, you know, help work with the team, but also provide solutions rather than sometimes just questions. So they did a great job.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Lewis. Are you confident that the people that needed to register their deer in these areas are going by license registration, or when they register their deer with the DNR and the online thing, or at the check stations, are we at 100% or close?
I don't know if I can answer that, but my understanding of just registration compliance itself is it's pretty high. I mean, there are some people who don't, but just based on the harvest and our population modeling, we aren't missing a lot of deer.
Any other questions? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, particularly for Mr. Luth, who did an excellent job with some real issues. And I just want to, again, for the record, state that we certainly had one major garbage hauler with the bulk of the state contracts in Minnesota that was very uncooperative and refused and really complicated your work. And that was Waste Management. That was particularly evident up in our area. So what happened there, Mr. Chair, was the little haulers that were squeezed out because the state of Minnesota gave the state contract in those areas to Waste Management, then Mr. Luce had to go back and literally beg them to come in and do the hauling. And that's not necessarily a purview of this committee, but I just want to make sure that Crow Wing County did an excellent job. The waste hauling company up there absolutely refused to cooperate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Keller.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Barbara Keller, and I am the Big Game Program Leader with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. It's my pleasure to be here today to give an update on our CWD management activities over this past fall surveillance season. So as many of you know who have seen our CWD response plan, our response can be boiled down to three main points, and that is to find the disease where it exists as early as possible, where it does exist, to reduce the risk of spread and transmission, and to advance our understanding of the disease. Now I'm going to be walking through the three areas of the state where we do have the disease and what our response has been over this past fall and what we've detected. So we'll start in the northern portion of our state, Deer Permit Area 604. This is in Crow Wing County. This area we classify as a recent early detection. This area first underwent surveillance as the result of a detection of a captive cervid facility that did have a CWD positive detection. As a result of that detection, we did surveillance in our free-ranging deer population around that area and did detect one dead deer that was found on the landscape did test positive for the disease. As a result of that positive free-ranging deer, we drew a management zone boundary around that area, and we created a new deer permit area, 604. Within this area, we changed our regulations to prevent the spread and transmission of the disease. So we liberalized harvest in this area. We had mandatory surveillance for all hunter-harvested deer, prevented the movement of whole carcasses out of the area until a not-detected result was received. A feeding and attractant ban was applied to the county within this area, as well as all surrounding counties. And with the detection of the free-ranging positive deer, we started the clock on a 3-year plan. So after 3 years of surveillance and management in this area, if we do not detect any additional positive deer, we may dissolve that boundary and conclude our response here. With one exception there is that is given that we have high confidence in this number of deer that we have sampled in that area. So we are now 1 year into that plan. So we have 1 year of fall surveillance under our belts. These two maps display our surveillance efforts in this area. On the left is the surveillance that we first conducted in response to the captive cervid facility. So before we had detected it in our free-ranging population, we had tested nearly 9,000 deer in this area until we did detect it in one positive deer that was found dead on the landscape. And that was in close proximity, 0.4 miles from that captive cervid facility that tested positive. So with the additional surveillance that we've done this fall, we've sampled nearly 13,000 deer in and around this area. So that gives us good confidence that we've detected the disease early on in the infection process. And so we don't believe it is widespread in this area. Again, though, we have 2 additional years of surveillance before we would conclude a response here, given no additional detections in the wild. Moving on to the central portion of our state, here we have what we call the central CWD surveillance area. This was created in response to another captive cervid facility. This was the result of a trace-out investigation from the Crow Wing County Farm in 2017, a deer that originated in the Crow Wing County facility that was moved to this Meeker County facility did in fact test positive for chronic wasting disease. So as a result of that, we drew some surveillance boundaries around this area and we began testing our free-ranging deer population. We also implemented a feeding ban in this county and surrounding counties. To date, we've tested just over 3,600 deer in this area. And again, we have a 3-year response plan based on our 3-year response based on our CWD response plan. And we have just concluded the third year of that surveillance this past fall. And so given that we have not detected the disease in the free-ranging deer population here, this response will be concluded. These boundaries will go away. We will not continue to have mandatory surveillance in this area. And the feeding ban will also sunset, which I'll speak about in a moment. As you are well aware, the Board of Animal Health did detect 2 additional positive captive cervid facilities in the state this year. Those are Douglas and Pine counties. We're working closely with the Board of Animal Health to learn about the results of the epidemiological investigation. So far, we've already conducted aerial flights over the Douglas and Pine County facilities to assess the risk to our free-ranging deer population, so to assess deer population distribution in proximity to those captive facilities to help us best determine how to respond to the situation. So we're currently working with the Board of Animal Health to determine what that response should look like. Another recent development is that we are including those counties in our deer feeding ban. So the commissioner did recently sign this rule, and it will be effective February 24th to include new counties in our feeding ban. On this map here, all of the counties that are shown in gray and pink will be within our deer feeding ban. Those that are in gray with the hash marks will also have the attractant ban. We apply the attractant ban when we find it in our free-ranging deer population. So we'll be adding those new counties as a result of those positive captive servant facilities. As I've mentioned, we are sunsetting that feeding ban in the area around that Meeker County positive detection. So beginning July 1st, those counties in yellow will be removed from our feeding ban. So it will remain in effect over the winter, and they will fall out of the feeding ban on July 1st. Moving on to our response in southeastern Minnesota, this is an area where we unfortunately have a persistent infection on the landscape. And so our response here has been more aggressive. So in this area, we've liberalized both buck and doe harvest. We've increased opportunity through special late season CWD hunts. We removed the antler point restriction where it was in effect. There's mandatory hunter surveillance of all harvested deer during the entirety of deer season, carcass movement restrictions. We've also created a control zone that's shown in yellow. And in that zone, we've increased our surveillance in an attempt to detect any spread of the disease outside of that persistent infection area. We also have feeding and attractant bans that are applied to those counties and surrounding counties. We don't have any determined sunset for these regulations as we continue to detect additional positive deer on the landscape. So these regulations will be in effect for the foreseeable future. This table and map shows the deer that we've sampled this past fall. All of the green dots represent the location of a hunter-harvested deer that was tested, and then the colored polygons represent deer that did test positive for chronic wasting disease. You can also see that as it's broken down by our deer permit areas in this table here. This is a result of our hunter surveillance. So we've sampled just over 12,000 deer in the southeastern portion of the state during our fall hunting season. We did detect the disease in 26 of those deer, and you can see how that's broken down by deer permit area. I will say one additional deer that was found dead on the landscape did also test positive for the disease, so that would bring the total to 27, and that was in deer permit area 646. So we have detected three new areas of disease within the southeastern portion of the state, and these red circles represent those areas. The northernmost area we have detected six cases of positive deer in close proximity to a positive facility in Winona County. So the yellow star, it's a little bit small there, but that represents the location of the positive Winona farm. And the other cases you can see are in close proximity to that location. Further south from that, we've detected four positive deer on the same section in the Money Creek area. And then to the east of that, we've also detected one positive deer in the La Crescent area. So unfortunate that we continue to see pick up new cases in new areas of the southeast, but important to keep in mind that our prevalence is still very low where it does exist. We expend a lot of agency effort to conduct the surveillance.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Keller, where that gold star is there in the Winona County on that on your map, is that a depopulated farm now, or is that one still in operation?
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am not sure about the answer to that. Dr. Glazer is indicating that it is depopulated.
Proceed.
Moving on, we do expend a lot of agency effort to conduct the surveillance that we do, including the North Central Zone, our control zone, the sick and dead deer that we test each year. We've tested just under 18,000 deer this past season, which is a large increase over what we've done in the past. And again, we have detected the disease in 27 of those deer. So important to point out that it is still at a very low prevalence. We have a lot of staff that work during our firearm season to collect these samples. So more than 400 people were working at a station over firearm season. But we also work closely with volunteers from the universities to help us in that effort. We're also looking at how we can improve efficiencies in the way that we collect samples. So this past year, we had our self-service sampling stations during the archery and muzzleloader seasons, where hunters simply dropped off heads and recorded information on cards that they left with the heads, and then our staff would later pick up those and sample them. So we'll be looking in the future at how we can improve the efficiency of how we're collecting samples to reduce some of that effort that we do need to expend. With regards to budget, in FY20, we are appropriated $2.77 million for our CWD efforts. To date, we've expended about $1.8 million for that effort, but our expenditures are not over for the season, so we are expecting expenses totaling more than $700,000 to come in prior to the end of the fiscal year. We do expect that we will expend that entire $2.77 million.
Dr. Keller, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, because I know when you look at the maps, you know, most of them we can link to kind of human-caused reasons with, you know, different facilities of why we might have positives. But I'm wondering if you have the resources you need to sort of investigate some of those other hot areas so that we can figure out why it is that we're getting positives in those areas. You know, I was looking at the different categories of spending, and I'm not sure if that falls into there or if you have the resources to do that.
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is certainly something that we continue to look at. Areas of the state where the disease has been detected, such as the Preston area, where we're not exactly sure why it is that it has appeared there. Although certainly we do have some risks in proximity to Wisconsin and other issues. So it is certainly something that we continue to explore and look into. However, once the disease is on the landscape, it doesn't necessarily matter how it got there as far as our response is. So certainly it is a matter of interest for us that we continue to explore in the future, because that will help us also understand where we can expect the disease to pop up in other locations of the state. So it's important. We also work with other states to look at how they're measuring risk throughout their states. We do have a risk-based surveillance model, but other states are also using different types of risk-based surveillance, and we're working closely with them currently to assess whether we should be adjusting the way that we assess risk on the landscape.
Representative
Becker-Finn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other question I had, I have lots of questions, but just wondering if, you know, do you foresee that we're going to need to expend more dollars where the Pine and Douglas and some of those other positives are? Because I know at the beginning you said, you know, these are areas because this is where we found it, but those are only the areas where we found it in the wild. And so I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit about that.
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, could you specify whether we need more funds to conduct surveillance in Pine and Douglas County? Is that your question?
Yeah, just kind of overall, as we're having more positives, you know, I mean, do you just draw from the Game and Fish Fund and other places as needed? You know, we allocate some, you know, it's sort of the same question, I guess, as the dumpster question.
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that there is currently a proposal to request additional funds for the next fiscal year, but that is under review within our department.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be my last question. As far as the deer feeding and attractant bans, you know, it seems like from a best practice scenario, has there been discussion within the DNR about making that statewide or a more permanent policy as far as risk and disease management?
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's certainly something we continue to discuss within our department, whether it's appropriate to apply that ban, a feeding ban, statewide. At this point, we're only applying it to those areas that we think are at highest risk for transmission of the disease. It's really important for us to consider the hunting public as we move along the road of CWD management, and it's really important that we don't lose their trust and confidence. And so we just have to make sure that if we're going to apply a ban that would affect so much of our hunting population, that we can justify that is indeed at a high risk for the disease.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think just to clarify, not everyone who feeds deer is a hunter. I think there's a lot of folks who probably think it's a nice thing to do and may be unwittingly helping to pass diseases. So you don't have to comment on that, but it just, you know, that's another piece of this I don't think the general public is necessarily aware of when they, oh, look at the cute deer at my bird feeder. So just wanted to point that out.
Representative Sandell and then Representative Fabian.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dr. Keller, I'm concerned about the sort of the fluid nature of where the deer may be living and migrating. Is the kind of research that you're doing being duplicated in either Wisconsin or Iowa? And to what extent does Minnesota DNR work with those states to assess the situation there and what they're doing to try to mitigate the crisis, I guess?
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're in nearly constant communication with our other neighboring state agencies, as well as in general in the Midwest. There are monthly phone calls that occur, as well as just we know each other very well, and we'll pick up the phone and talk to each other about what's going on. So we can learn a lot about what's happening in other states. Wisconsin serves as a great model in comparison to Illinois with their approach to the disease. We're following the Illinois model in that we're being very aggressive in the management that we do. And Illinois has shown some success in keeping prevalence low over time. And so we're hoping that we will see that same success. There are other states as well. I previously served with the Missouri Department of Conservation in a similar role, and they also manage the disease following the Illinois model and also have also shown success with keeping prevalence low.
Representative Sandell.
One more, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a national task force dealing with CWD? I should probably know that, but I'm sorry, I don't.
Dr. Keller.
What? Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that there are national task force dealing with it at the federal level. And then there are also regional task force. So there's our Midwest Health Committee, Wildlife Health Committee, that's within MAFWA, the Midwest Association of Fish and Wildlife. And so that is staffed with all of the wildlife health experts from the Midwest states. They meet annually, if not more frequently. And one of the major topics of discussion is chronic wasting disease.
Thank you, Dr. Keller. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Keller, thank you for being here. I'm curious, you mentioned Iowa and Wisconsin a little bit on slide number 13, got all the dots and so forth. I'm wondering if you have the positive tests or a like map for both Wisconsin and Iowa that you could get to us, please.
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we can get you maps of the positive locations of deer in Iowa and Wisconsin. Is that correct?
Yep.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Dr. Keller, I'm curious on the self-sampling that you did for archery and muzzleloader season. How many samples did you collect during that self-sampling period?
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have those numbers at hand. I can get those to you. I will say that, you know, the majority of deer that are harvested occur during firearm season, and that certainly played the same trend as far as deer that we were sampling. But I can get the numbers on the self-service stations to you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Keller, do you know right offhand if any of those tested positive that were during the self-sampling period?
Dr. Keller.
Chair, members of the committee, I want to say yes, that we did have some positives early on in the process, but I'll need to confirm that with our numbers and get back to you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just kind of, I think my last question for now, but you gave some numbers in terms of the number of deer that had been checked and so forth in Crow Wing County. I'm looking for that slide, and it was 12.
Almost 13,000.
12 or 13,000. And then also for down in the southeast part. How does that number compare to last year or the average number of deer that are taken in those areas during the hunting season?
Well, I was, Mr. Chair, members, I will say that for the Crow Wing County area, the regulation was that deer must be taken to a sampling station during the entirety of firearm season. And we believe that we have high compliance with that regulation. So I would say that, the number of deer that were sampled in deer permit area 604 in the Crow Wing County area would be very close to the number of deer that were harvested.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if I didn't. How does the number of deer tested compare to the number of deer harvested in previous years in those areas? I'm just curious to know how it's expanded. I'm guessing it's substantially more deer, but I'm wondering about the numbers. That's all.
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members, yeah, we certainly have increased dramatically the number of deer that we're testing every year.
And I think Representative Fabian and maybe Dr. Ostrom will have the data. I think SIDRAP had the information on Iowa and the Dakotas in terms of positives. I thought I saw a press release recently on how much they have. So, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Keller, earlier we heard Rep. Sandell talk about deer movement. And recently I thought I saw that there's some ongoing research at DNR, and maybe we're getting some new information about deer movement. And I peeked ahead in your presentation and I didn't see anything. Is that research, I guess, is it conclusive at this point? Because I'm hearing that deer are known to move now maybe in excess of 60 miles. Is that true or am I getting bad information?
Dr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. We do have a deer movement study that's ongoing right now in the southeastern portion of our state with the goal of helping us better understand deer movements to help inform management for chronic wasting disease. It's not concluded yet. The study's not concluded. We have an excellent website on our DNR webpage, which describes the study, what we're doing, and it provides some preliminary findings. But again, they are just preliminary, so we would wait until the result or the study is conclusive before we would make any major changes to the way that we manage the disease or draw boundaries. But I will say deer traveling in excess of 60 miles isn't unheard of. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we had that finding as a part of this study. I don't know specifically off the top of my head whether that is one of the furthest distances that we've seen. But with deer movements, you do occasionally, you will always have outliers at the extreme end where a few deer travel very far, but the majority or the average distance will be much lower than that. So it comes down to whether we would want to measure for the extremes of the few deer that do travel those extreme distances or for what the majority of deer would travel. But again, that study is ongoing, so it has not yet been concluded.
Dr. Keller, if you could proceed. We've got to go through quite a few presentations yet. So.
Okay, moving on slide 16. As far as what we have planned for this winter, we are conducting targeted culling with the help of USDA Wildlife Services in the southeastern portion of our state. And this map shows the areas where we are doing that culling in the red, orange, and yellow squares surrounding multiple positive detections of deer. That's the footprint at which targeted culling is occurring. It is not occurring at a permit area scale or any larger than that. We are not planning to do targeted culling in the northern 604 deer permit area, given we did not detect any additional free-ranging positive deer this fall. Currently in this area, we're working with 63 cooperating landowners. We have access to over 15,000 acres. And as of last Friday, 135 deer had been removed, 54 from the Winona area and 81 from the Preston area. We do have two deer that have tested suspect positive as a result of the targeted culling efforts. One of those in the Winona area in close proximity to that captive facility, and then one in our Preston area. So these have tested positive on the screening ELISA test. It will be a few days before we get the IHC confirmatory result for those. That information will be updated on our website. As far as what we have planned for the next hunting season, we'll be using this time prior to that to assess how our regulation changes and surveillance efforts could be improved over before the next fall, assessing whether any additional positive detections of deer warrant any management zone boundary changes, and again, continuing to work with the board with regards to the investigation of the captive service facilities and assessing what sorts of surveillance needs we will need in that area in the upcoming fall. There is likely to be some level of surveillance around these facilities. We're just not sure what exactly that's going to look like at this point. Finally, to summarize our disease management response for this past year, it's important to remember, although we do continue to find positive deer in portions of our state, our prevalence is still low and our footprint remains low. And we have an aggressive approach aimed at keeping it that way. And we also have an adaptive approach as we learn how our regulations and surveillance efforts can be more effective. We do intend to change those accordingly. And importantly, we have to keep our public and our hunters and our other stakeholders with us along the way. It would be impossible for us to manage this disease without their cooperation. And with that, I'll take any additional questions that you might have.
Members, any questions? Dr. Keller, could you provide the committee later the number of deer licenses in these respective zones over the last few years so we can look at the number of people who are actually getting licenses and the impact on the number of hunters in the zones where there is CWD?
Mr. Chair, yes, we can provide that information.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Dr. Linda Glazer, Board of Animal Health. Welcome, Dr. Glazer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here this afternoon. My name is Linda Glazer. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Animal Health. And just wanted to give an overview of the Farm Survey Program and sort of an update from the update we provided during the October meeting. You have a handout in front of you. I'll go kind of walk through that. You'll see that we have a total of 304 farm servitudes that are now registered with the Board of Animal Health. This is a reduction of about 45 herds since we last provided the update in October. There's a species breakdown of the different species we have in those herds. We have fully implemented all the legislative changes that were made during last year's session, so we have those fully implemented now into our program. Just a summary of the 2019 CWD surveillance. You can see that we've tested 2,172 farm servants during that year. 2,143 were not detected, and we had only 20 that were unsuccessfully tested for about a 99% successful test rate for last year. You'll see the herd cancellations as well as on then continuing on page 3. Our compliance, due to sort of chronic lack of compliance, we did issue cancellations for 8 herds in 2019. Once we cancel a herd registration, the producer is no longer allowed to possess live cervidae, and so the animals have to be removed from the herd. 5 of these herds were depopulated, 1 herd signed a compliance agreement, and then 2 herds are pending an outcome, and one of those herds specifically was delayed for closing due to the stop movement order that expired January 29th. You can see that in the second page is a map, an updated map of those 304 herds and their distribution throughout the state, with the primary color of that dot being the primary species of animal in that herd. The compliance table, you can look through and see where we've identified violations with our regulations, and then we issue violations, and then without remediation or mitigation of those violations, then we go issue civil penalties, and those are outlined as well. And note on the fencing and exclosure compliance, we have had 3 of those violations to this point for the redundant gating that was passed in the legislature last year and became fully in place on December 1st of last year. We're now incorporating that inspection for redundant gates into our annual inspections for farm service producers. Then the next section is related to our CWD infected herd that was identified in December of this past year in Douglas County. We have had, during this investigation, we have quarantined a total of 7 herds. And the Douglas County herd, that herd was depopulated. That was a very short-lived herd. It had only been in place about 10 months before a positive animal was identified. Those animals traced back to the Pine County herd, and we identified another animal in that herd infected with CWD, and that herd was put down as well. So we have now 2 herds remaining that have CWD-exposed animals in there. In their herds, meaning the some of the animals in their herds had been housed with a CWD positive animal in the past 5 years from this investigation. Those 2 herds are in Wadena County and Chisago County, and we have appraised those animals, and we're waiting to find out if there is federal indemnity available to potentially to get those animals purchased by USDA, put down, and then tested. So we still have testing to go in this investigation. We are still awaiting test results of the Pine County CWD infected herd as well. And we have initiated, we initiated in 2019 a sample collector authorization program. So going forward, as of January 1st, 2020, no one should be collecting samples from farm servants unless they're authorized by the board to do so. We went through a training program last year. We've authorized 132 people to collect samples. We're working with the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory to ensure that those people that submit tissues are authorized. If not, they would have to pay for them, and then we have to follow up with them to let them know they can no longer collect tissues. So we're working with producers, veterinarians, and others that want to be authorized, and we're continuing. We expect to get more people authorized to collect CWD samples in the future. You'll see a map of the board's annual animal health CWD endemic area. That area was slightly expanded just to, in the beginning of this year, as the rules related to our establishing our endemic area is based on finding confirmed CWD positive wild deer. And so once the DNR identifies wild deer infected with CWD, we look at establishing the endemic area a minimum of 15 miles around any of those known positive wild deer, and any farm servants within that area, any farm servant herds, are subject to additional regulations of movement restrictions. And primarily it's for the reason of preventing any movement of those animals out of those herds due to the risk potential that CWD may go across the fence. So we updated that endemic area just in January with the fall findings from the 2019 hunting season. And then the last map is an update just of the national map of where CWD has been found across the country. And that's an update I have for the committee.
So I've got Representative Wagenius, then Becker Finn, and then Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you, on your sheet, you talk about Douglas County and the herd, it's been depopulated. I like that word. And then you say the fencing will be maintained for 5 years. But it's my understanding that prions can last more than 5 years. So why do you only limit the fencing to 5 years?
Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, our regulations allow us authority to require the property owner to manage the fencing for 5 years. That's what we have within our authorities, and they have to be able to maintain the fencing to prevent any ingress of wild servants into the enclosure.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, but science is telling you that the prions can last longer, so have you asked for a change in your authority?
Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at this point, we have not asked for a change of our authorities.
Representative Wagenius.
Why not?
Dr. Glazer.
The Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the science is rather undetermined about what is that longer time period. We are unable to test the environment for chronic wasting disease, and we do not have, there's not any science peer-reviewed publication information on how long chronic wasting disease will survive in the environment. We know about other prion diseases that, you know, information has been published, but not chronic wasting disease. So we don't have a timeline of what that that survival is or a way to measure it.
Representative McGinnis.
It does seem that if you think it could last longer, and that certainly we've heard testimony to that, that you should be protecting the rest of the deer longer. I mean, I just don't get the reasoning of saying we're going to wait when waiting could mean other deer would be infected and the problem would expand. That doesn't make common sense to me right now. And
Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the science on the how long it lasts in the environment is really unknown at this point, unfortunately. We have the ability to, within our authorities, to require 5 years.
I think we'll be hearing from the scientist in a few minutes. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering, looking at the compliance and violations, do we have repeat violators, you know, or is it kind of across the board that people are struggling with different things, or, you know, just looking at the base number, it's hard to tell. I'm just curious if there are any kind of trends or sort of bad actors that you can point to.
Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do have, if you look at the herd cancellations, I would say that goes toward our sort of chronic producers that chronically have a difficult time meeting the regulations. And we look at, you know, this period over time and their ability to, you know, comply with the program requirements. And that's when we, you know, look at potentially canceling a herd registration when they're not able to do that. The others, if, you know, we issue a notice of violation, it's sort of a point of education, also sets a timeline with the producer on remedying the problem. And then if that is doesn't happen, we will then issue a notice of civil penalty. So you'll see that for the number of violations that we issue, the number of civil penalties is quite a bit less. And then we work with them, you know, then if the civil penalty, you know, they still have to remediate the problem, but the civil penalty usually reinforces the need for compliance.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so with the running at large or, you know, any of those things, we're kind of relying on self-report, I assume. And also wondering if you could speak to, I know there was, you know, one of those sort of irregular sort of mutant bucks escaped from a facility somewhere and was later harvested by a hunter. Mm-hmm. A bow hunter this year. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that and kind of how do we make sure that person is being held responsible and that that doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, regarding running at large, which really refers to farm servants that escape from the facilities, we do have a notice of violation and then a civil penalty we assess. But a lot of the times, it's not necessarily self-reporting. We also have the options that people are, you know, maybe finding animals with tags, you know, in their ears of reporting. We also get reports from the Department of Natural Resources. So there are a number of eyes out there that are, you know, kind of monitoring situations and reporting these back to us. We do work with the producers. They have to develop a recovery plan for how they'll get their animals back. If their animals are killed or harvested outside of the fence, we work with either Department of Natural Resources, if they've recovered those animals, to make sure they get tested for chronic wasting disease. And we've had for those the one producer that I know of that we've had more than one escape was one of the ones that we canceled the registration for that herd. So,
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you do the testing of the brain tissue, is it 100% accurate?
Dr. Weiser. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the immunohistochemistry test is the gold standard for testing to detect prions in cervids. But when we get a test result back, it's called not detected, and that's for a reason. We cannot assure that the animal's negative. We can only assure that the prions have not been detected in the samples we test. So we understand in the infection process, there's a period of time, an incubation period, where the animal's infected, but it can't be detected with the tests that we have. So when we're doing the test, if the prions are truly in the lymph nodes or OBEX, they will be picked up on this test. But if the infection is potentially early, before the prions get to those tissues, we wouldn't be able to detect them.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so what would you say, 80% accurate, 50% accurate on your tests?
Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm gonna leave that for the science group to tell you. I think they would be.
Well, then one more question, Mr. Chair. Have you ever done any of the live testing that they're doing in the other states?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have done live testing on some of the animals in our herds where chronic wasting disease has been detected, specifically doing a rectal tissue biopsy. And that requires sedating the animals, sampling a piece of the rectal biopsy tissue, and submitting it for the same testing procedure, the immunohistochemistry test that we do for the lymph nodes and OBEX. But the farm servant program requirements for the program that are set by kind of a state federal cooperative standard only allows for the immunohistochemistry test right now for in these specific tissues, the lymph node and OBEX. So there are new tests coming up that we hope get validated or considered for the program, but in order to meet the program requirements, we're limited to this particular test at this time.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Doctor, some of these cervid farms have, I don't know what you call it, for better word, I'll call it a canned hunt. Are the animals harvested in these canned hunts, are they tested also?
Dr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, our regulations require that 100% of the animals that either die or harvested on these farms are tested for chronic wasting disease. So every animal that is harvested in one of these hunt preserves is required to be tested.
Thank you, Dr. Glazer. Representative Fabian, I want to get the scientists up if we could, because we're running out of time. And so they were each supposed to get 20 minutes, and they're probably going to have to share 20 minutes. And if your questions on that, hopefully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. So, and the scientists can probably help out too. So, Dr. Glazer, when you say that 100% are required to be submitted for testing, there's a wide variety of tests that are done. What do you say the compliance rate is on 100%? Is it 100% or is it 99.3 or 102?
Well, oh, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, from the data on the front of the page, we can show that of the samples that are submitted, 99% of them are successfully tested. In other words, we get a test result that tells us what about CWD. We do have animals that die that are not tested for various reasons. You know, if they once an animal dies, especially in summer, these tissues can decompose rapidly, and so the samples aren't suitable for testing. So we make sure every producer understands it's better to attempt to submit samples rather than not. But we do have animals that die and are not sampled. I don't have those numbers in front of me. I can't give you a percentage right now of, you know, how many animals die during the year and then are not tested.
Thank you, Ms.
I can get that for you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Larson.
you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. I am Dr. Peter Larson, assistant professor at the Department of Veterinary and Biomedical Sciences, University of Minnesota. Sorry, in the interest of time, I'll be clicking through these slides a little bit more rapidly than normal, so forgive me for rushing through things. Okay, I'm here today to provide an update on our research and outreach activities, the research associated with the diagnostic test development, and then some of the more recent outreach activities that we've been performing across the state of Minnesota over the past few months. I think we all understand that CWD represents a threat to multiple economic sectors across the state, is a threat to the rich heritage that surrounds cervids, and we must do all that we can to protect that rich heritage. And that requires an immediate and sustained research and outreach effort, not just here in Minnesota, but across the United States, across North America. So update on our research activities. Just to remind everyone, this is our CWD diagnostic development team. This is the core team that many of you interacted with during the last legislative session. We have secured a number of collaborations over recent months that include NIH Rocky Mountain Labs, Colorado State University's Prion Research Center, and those are proving to be very important for the updates that I'm about to provide. We have some issues here with the projection here. Yeah, I believe you have the slides printed off in front of you, so we should be okay. So our goal is to develop advanced CWD diagnostics that are faster, cheaper, more sensitive, easier to use. And what we've said is we want to develop prototypes that are available within 2 years. Those prototypes, to be functional with hunter-harvested deer, live deer, and environmental samples. In 2019, we secured $2 million to the Rapid Ag Response Fund and also $1.8 million through the Minnesota Legislature and through LCCMR to support these research activities, develop advanced diagnostic tests. Those funds in 2019 supported development of a new prion research laboratory in the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. The space became available in August of 2019. The paint dried in early September, and we moved in. All the essential equipment for this new prion-focused wet lab was secured last fall, final piece of essential equipment arriving in December. We have established 4 independent lines of research aimed at advancing CWD diagnostic tools. I won't be able to go into detail on these, but they include antibody engineering, developing a novel class of antibodies that have a greater binding efficiency with CWD prions, also detection of CWD biomarkers in blood by looking at RNA expression profiles. I'm in bold here, I have light-based nanotechnologies and protein amplification methods, and these are two areas of research that are starting to pan out, and I'm going to dig down a little bit more detail into these. The first in the light-based nanotechnology advancement, this is our first publication that comes out of Dr. O's lab, first acknowledged, LCCMR acknowledged publication, focuses on advanced plasmic biosensor development, and I won't attempt to go into details of biosensor development or plasmic biosensors. Dr. O is here, and he can help answer those questions. But I just want to say that it's research like this. This is bleeding edge. This is bleeding edge research that's being published in high-quality impact journals. This type of research is what's going to help us develop that next class of advanced CWD tests. That provides the foundation for we would call them next-generation CWD protein detection devices. And that's part of our long-term research effort. I'm thrilled to announce today that on the protein amplification R&D side of things, we reached a major milestone on January 24th of this year, and that is that our new prion research laboratory has RT-Quick functionality. There's a media release that I believe is being circulated that covers this development. We were able to confirm a CWD positive sample in 9 hours of testing using this protein amplification method. And I really want to thank our collaborators at NIH Rocky Mountain Labs for helping make this possible. And just to dig in a little bit in the time that I have, this RT-Quick method stands for real-time quaking-induced conversions. And I usually have slinkies that I use to help explain the concept of prions. But essentially this test, it takes a You could take a test tube of normal prions, and then you have a seed taken from a CBD positive, let's say, control sample. You put that seed inside the tube with the normal prions, and you incubate and shake it. And you do that. And as that seed interacts with the normal prions, it causes them to change their shape and misfold. There's a dye that starts binding to those, and that emits a signal. And so that graph that you see in the lower right-hand corner, when that goes screaming hop up in intensity, that occurred within 9 hours. And this was a CWD positive lymph node that we used to confirm that the test is working. That all you're seeing with that curve is that the prions are growing, if you will. They're becoming misformed, similar to the misformed shape of the pathogenic CWD prion. So this test, this RT quick test, is useful for both postmortem and antemortem samples. So it can be performed in tissues, blood, saliva, feces, but also soil. So Dr. Glazer was correct that the most commonly used tests right now are not able to identify prions in something like soil environmental samples. But this test, this class of protein amplification tests, like RT-QuIC, there's another one called PMCA, they can be used for that. They can. And we're going to start collaborating more closely with the Board of Mental Health to be able to take soil samples and identify prions in those soil samples. So RT-QuIC can be improved upon using advanced technologies. This is one avenue of our research focus. There's probably about 5 or 6 teams across the United States who are focusing on improving RT-QuIC using microfluidic technology, using some of the technologies that Dr. O's lab is comfortable with working with and designing. And so we believe that we can make RT-QuIC a faster assay, if you will, and try to reduce the footprint of that test using advanced microfluid technologies. But it's very useful for a range of CBD research activities. We are collaborating with both the DNR and Board of Mental Health on samples that we'll be using this RT-QuIC method on. In particular, the DNR, this is Dr. Michelle Carstensen's idea, and it's a beautiful experiment. That we have a set of 500 tissues from 500 deer. In that set of 500 deer, there are 12 positive mixed in. We do not know which of the 500 are the positive samples. And so what we're going to do is to work through those 500 samples using this RT-QuIC method and see, can we identify the 12 positives that were identified with ELISA and IHC methods? Can we independently identify that using RT-QuIC? Dr. Tiffany Wolf, who is here today, is going to be helping us validate the RT-QuIC method using this sample set of 500 deer from the DNR. But we're also talking with the Board of Mental Health to secure environmental samples from CBD-positive farms, those farms that have gone positive over the last 10 years, because we can start to answer questions, hopefully, as Representative Wagenius was pointing out, can we identify these prions in soil samples from these depopulated farms? And we believe that we can with these protein amplification methods. So this test is not validated yet by the USDA.
Representative Wagenius actually had a question.
Yep, sorry. Representative Wagenius?
Let me just ask right now, is it fair to say that we can assume that prions can last beyond 5 years?
Dr. Larson.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, the question is it fair to say that we can assume that the prions can last beyond 5 years? Biology, nature is messy. And so I would say that there are studies showing that some prion, it's complex. It depends on the ecological conditions at the site. It depends on the soil. What types of soil are there? What is that binding? How are those prions binding and interacting to the soil, right? Freeze, thaw, how do all these things influence prion effectivity? So there's some studies showing, 4 or 5 years, but there's others that extend that out to 10 years, yes. And so, and we can also look at research done on scrapie, right, on this issue, another prion disease. So I would say that an arbitrary cutoff of 5 years is probably not, we need to perform the science in Minnesota to understand the ecology of CWD in Minnesota in order to help provide that information to the Board of Animal Health.
Representative Wagenius.
I get that. I like science. But in the meantime, if we think that they can last beyond 5 years, wouldn't it be wise to protect the rest of the deer herd until we are sure what's going to happen?
Dr. Larson.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, I can provide the publications, the science that's been done. Our research lab, with this test and with the advisory, the expert advisory panel that's been organized by SIDRAP, we can help provide the information to those authorities who can make that decision. Now, what I would say is that I don't want to recommend that the board extends that 5-year time frame without providing them the most accurate science that's been done up till now, so that can be an informed decision.
You could also provide those to us, and we could make the decision.
Absolutely. You'll hear from Dr. Ostrom next, and our team. We can provide that scientific literature that's been published till now, and can help inform that decision. Absolutely. So this RT quick test, it's not validated yet by the USDA, but we understand that they are starting the process to validate RT quick. There's a lot of excitement about these protein amplification assays. So in the coming years, you're going to be hearing more about RT quick, and I anticipate that the USDA will be validating that test ultimately. It's a more sensitive assay than IHC or ELISA. So to summarize our research developments, we've made important progress both on the nanotechnology and prion amplification R&D effort. RT-QuIC is really a major milestone for our diagnostic, our new prion lab that would not have been possible without support from the legislature and through the Minnesota Extension Rapid Egg Response Fund. So we have ongoing collaborations with a diverse team of scientists. I sat in this chair a year ago, and Representative Wagenius asked me, what is the University of Minnesota doing on CWD education outreach? And to be honest, I did not have a good answer, and I squirmed. And I said, we need to do more. And so in the months following that hearing, we have our team has launched a really remarkable array of education outreach efforts across the state to connect with Minnesotans. So I want to announce, and I think this has been circulated over the last few weeks, but we at the University of Minnesota, we're forming the Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach, or MinPro. I give a link to the website there. This is a center that currently consists of around 14 faculty from across the campus, the University of Minnesota campus. And we're all brought together to focus on key research questions pertaining to CWD and other protein misfolding diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, but also education and outreach. And I'm going to highlight some of those activities here real quickly. This is our core MinPro outreach team that are performing events across the state, but also developing new educational tools. We have reached over 2,700 Minnesotans through direct in-person outreach events over the past 5 months. And these are lectures, presentations. We have displays, interactive displays. Just yesterday at the Science Museum, there were over 900 families that went through and interacted with our outreach team about chronic wasting disease. There's a picture there of a child watching a CWD animation to learn about how prions move through deer. We've even done outreach events at restaurants where I take springs and I explain the biology of prions. I would say that we heard you, Representative Wagenius, and others, and we are doing everything that we can to get the word out about chronic wasting disease. We also heard Rep. Lee, who asked me in October, what is your team doing to reach to our Southeast hunting community? And we also did not have a good answer at that time. So since then, we are translating our fact sheets into multiple languages. This is an example of our Hmong translation. We are working to translate our CWD Watch website into Hmong and Korean, and we are planning additional outreach events that will coincide before the hunting season, all aimed at connecting with our Southeast Asian hunting community. We're also expanding our outreach efforts to include Minnesota's Amish communities and tribal nations. Dr. Tiffany Wolf is assisting with the human dimensions aspect of this and has close ties with the tribal nations, and so we'll be she can help answer questions on how we will be launching biosurveillance efforts with our tribal nation partners. Also, Dr. Roxanne Larson and Mark Schwabenlander, they're using cutting-edge tools like CAT scans of deer heads to develop 3D printed models that can be used to show hunters or turbid farmers or the public of where to find lymph nodes in an actual 3D printed head. And I'll just highlight this in the short time that I have. This is sort of late breaking news. We got this animation yesterday. That's not a top hat that the deer is wearing. That's gonna be a stand that the deer head is sitting in. We're gonna 3D print this model. Dr. Roxanne Larson and Mark Schwabenlander dissected this white-tailed deer head. They then scanned it using a CT scan. It's going to be 3D printed at the University of Minnesota. Those two pale nuggets in there are the retropharyngeal lymph nodes. The 3D model look pretty much like this. The red tissues are salivary glands. Those just happen to be the tissues that hunters mistake and most often for lymph nodes. So we can use this 3D printed model to actually look at the retropharyngeal lymph nodes, and you can reach in and pull them out. Okay, so this is something that we expect in the coming weeks to be printed, and then we're going to start incorporating this into our outreach activities. So this is a novel hands-on educational tool. I also want to say that University of Minnesota, we're united in CWD outreach. We are partnering with SIDRAP now through MinPro and working together on CWD-related outreach activities. I would say that there is not another institution in the United States that has the level of outreach and communication that's been assembled by SIDRAP and MinPro. I think it's remarkable, and it's a shining star of what's happened over the last year. So with that, I thank you, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
I am going to ask that Dr. Ostrom come up because we've got relatively little time. And just Dr. Larson, that you would be available if people want to come out to their communities and do presentations, et cetera, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say that our MinPro team, reach out to us, let us know. We are there to help, and we can connect with your communities.
Dr. Ostrom. That includes Roseau, correct, Dr. Larson? You'd go all the way to Roseau?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. I'm Dr. Michael Osterholm. I direct the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. As we load up the slides, let me just say that I promise I will be short. We have a very critical 3 p.m. call on coronaviruses right now, so that I will obviously jump from one disease to the other here, so I'm going to have to be fast. First of all, let me just say that this topic has continued here in Minnesota, and I want to amplify what Dr. Larson just said. I think our University of Minnesota is one of the most uniquely qualified organizations in the country, institutional-wise, to work on this issue. This is a paper that we published last year in MBio, a major paper. It was really the first really definitive review and discovery discussion on the issue of interspecies transmission beyond cervids. This was published in MBio. This has been downloaded now more than 14,000 times, one of the most read papers in this journal. Note that several of the authors, I want to just point out Mark Zabel, who's at Colorado State University, is one of the preeminent experts in the whole issue of prion transmission in cervids. And the last author, Brian Appleby, is actually the director of the Human Surveillance Center at Case Western University for human-related disease. We also have established a chronic wasting disease resource center at the SIDRAP. Our MBio paper, amongst other resource center activities, are there. This is the number one linked site on the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention site, as well as our papers, the number one there. I just, in sake of time, just say we have established a very unique program expert advisory group. Includes 57 national, international, world-renowned and distinguished leaders, public health, medicine, science, wildlife, and agriculture. Our advisory group includes representatives from six countries, Canada, France, England, the Netherlands, Norway, and the United States, 34 PhDs, 12 DVMs, 8 MDs, 12 wildlife managers, and 8 leaders from conservation hunting organizations. It even features internationally renowned experts on bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Both Sir Roy Anderson and John College were the leaders back in the 1980s working on BSE in that area. The organizations represented here include the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Prey on Disease Pathology Surveillance Center, the National Institutes of Health, U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Public Health Agency of Canada, 14 different academic institutions, and more than 25 state and provincial agencies. In terms of the issue of what we're dealing with here is our content is vetted by this group. I don't think there's any other content in the world that's more vetted on CWD than passing it through these 57 experts. We feel very confident that it represents state-of-the-art and why it is the one that the CDC continues to promote. We include detailed FAQs, up-to-date CWD news, maps, summarized federal legislation initiatives, and extensive links to CWD content and other websites. We also have, as I mentioned, frequently asked questions. These are constantly updated, vetted through our group. And so I think many of the questions I heard even asked today are answered on this website area here. One of the areas that we've been actively involved and why we got so involved with this issue to begin with is that CWD is not a static disease situation. In fact, the changing of strains, meaning the maturation over time and the mutation of these strains, has tremendous public health implications. Prion strains are characterized by slight differences in their shape. Changes in the shape can take place when the prion passes through hosts. The more hosts that pass through, the more changes. Well, we've seen what has happened in the last 25 years relative to the incidence in deer and cervids as it's moved. Unique CWD strains have emerged as disease transmission continues both among farmed and cervid populations. These novel CWD strains can have unique host ranges, and at least six different CWD strains have been recently identified. This is a paper that was published in the Emerging Infectious Disease Journal at CDC in 2017. I want to point this out because last year in hearings you had here, several people pointed out, well, this will never transmit to humans. You can't even transmit it to mice. And technically they were correct up until a few years ago. This paper actually details how now we can actually transmit the new strains of CWD to mice, which is actually considered almost as a bridge or a precursor to the potential transmission for humans. So as these strains change, we have to be cognizant of what the implications are. One of the areas that we've been working on is information for the world about this issue. This is a webinar that we had on December 11th, 2019. One of your distinguished colleagues on this committee not only attended it, but asked a question, Representative Becker-Finn, was on this call. To give you an idea of what our reach has been, in this particular webinar, we had over 300 participants from 38 states, six Canadian provinces, and five countries. Since this time, this has now been downloaded by over 1,600 individuals, this presentation. So again, this particular presentation highlighted the challenges of understanding the risk of CWD as these change, strains continue to change. Other activities, we have current information directly from experts in the field. We do a number of podcasts as well as webinars. We have a podcast coming up that will be actually recorded next week with the chairman, Representative Hansen, and Republican Representative Ed Arcot, and Russ Mason and Nick Benzito, both representing areas of the deer area. And the whole purpose of this podcast is what legislators and legislative staff should know about CWD as they're having these discussions. We want to thank you, Representative Larson, for doing this.
So, Dr. Ostrom, Representative Wagenius has a question, wants to know something. So.
Okay, I'm sorry, excuse me.
Well, I think let's get to the next page, and when he talks about ongoing activities, then I'd like to ask my question.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to point out that we continue to have a series of podcasts and webcasts, which are really a wonderful way to reach the world, and that's what we have continued to do. I'm not sure that answers the question for you. I'm trying to get through in time. We also are very concerned about the issue of management of infected cervid carcasses. This has been an issue. You heard of it earlier today with the landfill issue. And so, as you know, prions can exist in the environment for years to decades, making infected carcasses that are improperly disposed of in the landscape a risk for transmission and spread. We just heard that discussion. A concern is growing regarding the safety of prions in landfill environments among waste management agencies, landfill operators, and the general public. All the recommendations have been to say this is the place to go. So what we've actually done is formed an international working group, CWD Carcass Management Work Group, to proactively address this issue and provide a comprehensive document that will be a resource to stakeholders. Members of this working group include world experts in landfill engineering, prion biology, human health, and wildlife management. includes organizational representatives from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Prion Disease Pathology Surveillance System, four academic institutions, and three state and provincial governments. It is co-chaired by myself and Dr. Shannon Bartlett-Hunt, who is actually an head of the engineering department at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, who also happens to be an expert on prions in groundwater. And so this is a very unique group, and we will be reporting back soon to you of the findings of this particular work group. This is the kind of work we're doing. So in conclusion, let me just say that CWD remains a critical wildlife management challenge that is spreading both by the movement of infected wild and captive cervids. The Alliance for Public Wildlife estimated that 7,000 to 15,000 CWD-infected cervids were consumed in 2017, with that number increasing potentially as much as 20% per year. The newly emerging CWD prion strains represent a new consideration for the risk of interspecies transmission, not just to other animals, but to humans. Our work is addressing the public health concern with the potential transmission of CWD prions to humans. And I also just want to emphasize one last point that Professor Larson emphasized. Again, we have a very unique collaborating working group now at the university between our two efforts, and with both international, national, and local outreach. And we appreciate your committee's support in the work that we've been doing. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius, and as she's getting ready for a question, I apologize for the length of the meeting. If there is anyone who came here to testify, I want to make sure that they were given the opportunity. If there's anyone who came here who wanted to make a comment, I would encourage them to get to the microphone while Representative Wagenius is asking her question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask the question. Would you say, is it fair to say that prions could last beyond 5 years? But then I see in your next to the last slide, you say prions can persist in the environment for years to decades.
Yes.
Dr.
Mr.
Oscar.
Chairman, Representative, I think, and Dr. Larson, I think, addresses correctly. We know prions can be in the environment for extended period of time. The question is, are they actually capable of being transmitted through any number of exposure potentials, even though they're there? And I think that's the big challenge, and I have to say the science is incomplete on that one. I don't think a five-year deadline is one, though, however, I feel comfortable with the biology, but I think we still have more work to do on that issue. And after we finish the carcass disposal issue, we actually are looking at taking that next issue up with the hard science to give you an answer. Just because they're there doesn't mean that they're actually a public health problem.
I understand that, but since we don't know,
yep,
and we don't want this to spread, we should not say you're home free after 5 years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I've always abided by the precautionary principle. I couldn't agree more.
Thank you.
Representative Green will be the last question. I do want to note, you know, we probably will have some bills relating to CWD, and if some of the testifiers would be available to come back then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was probably one of my questions, if they're coming back, because I have a series of questions, and maybe I can give them a heads up. I don't expect the answers now, but one of the questions was, how accurate is your test? What percentage rates? The other is that, you know, one thing that you said, and I've heard it before too, that that the prions are changing. Are you actively manipulating the prions to change to see if you can get them into other mice, for instance? I'd like to find out that answer. And then maybe one day we could meet in my office as well. I have other questions as far as I know there were some questions on the spread of through bacteria and other issues. There's a ton of questions to ask, but obviously we don't have time. But if just a heads up that if you can't get them to me before, be interested in hearing them in the next meeting.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, I'm very happy to meet with you at any time to go through this. First of all, let me just say, from the accuracy of the test, it's highly, highly, highly accurate. It's as good as any test that we have in terms of actually determining the presence or absence of a real prion. Number two, in terms of manipulating the prions we're talking about that are being used in these studies are actually naturally occurring prions that are coming out of the animal population. It's just that if you did studies 10 years ago using the prions available at that time, your results were absolutely valid. The problem is the prions have changed, and so you could rerun the same test and find a very different answer today. That's what's happening in terms of challenging the other animals. As far as the cause, I just have to reiterate, prions are the cause of CWD. There's absolutely no debate about that from a scientific standpoint.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.